The following recording was produced by Christ Redeemer Church of Hanover, New Hampshire. The speaker is Pastor Don Williman. You may find more information on the church and its various resources on the web at www.christredeemerchurch.org.
Good afternoon. It's great to be with you. And you can see on page 6 of your bulletin, there's a variety of passages printed. If you have a Bible, I encourage you to open your Bible and you can look off of there as well. You see these things in greater context, but this is going to be one of those sermons where we kind of take a step back from the particularity of a text and try to see broader themes. Sometimes it's easier to see certain things from a bird's eye view. But allow me to read the passages that are printed there from 1 Peter chapter 1 and 2 and 3. Therefore, preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Now, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled. But in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. For it is better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. May God bless the reading of His Word. Now, we have been working our way through the New Testament book of 1 Peter, and it's a letter written by the Apostle Paul to a group of Christians who were suffering persecution, suffering marginalization at least, but certainly suffering persecution for their faith in Jesus Christ. They're in the furnace, they're in the fire of faith. And last week we began to consider a theme in the letter. Doug began to consider a theme in the letter for you guys here of how they are, how we, if we're struggling in the same sort of way, to respond to our non-believing neighbors, even those who are deriding us because of the gospel. And Peter here tells the people that he's writing to how to represent Jesus Christ in a society or to a society that is despising them because of Jesus Christ. And this calling, this responsibility of representing Jesus Christ is called what we would call evangelism. And as soon as we use that word evangelism, it seems to me that both non-Christians and Christians can get all nervous about this, because I think there's many false conceptions about the idea of evangelism out there. Perhaps ideas of moral superiority or something somebody trying to sell something or push something, maybe even trying to manipulate other people into believing. One of the things that's very common in the background of evangelism in our particular context is the idea that, well, that's just pushing my private or personal beliefs on other people. And that just doesn't seem right, you know? Everybody should kind of make up their own, have their own beliefs, and I shouldn't be trying to push my beliefs on other. The comedian George Carlin said, religion is like a pair of shoes. Find one that fits for you, but don't make me wear your shoes. You know, so it's that kind of a mindset. And there's all sorts of insecurity that grows from this, or that, pardon me, insecurity that's inherent in this and actually grows from this. As a matter of fact, often, sometimes when people think of evangelism, they think of it as almost like a campaigning sort of a way, like trying to get votes for Jesus. And, you know, I've got this poor friend Jesus who needs, this poor guy Jesus who needs friends. Would you please be his friend, you know? And there's this, almost this guilt trip sort of a thing. But here's the reality is Jesus doesn't need your help. he really doesn't need your help, but you desperately need Jesus. And the problem here is we forget really at the very heart of what the nature of the gospel is all about. And the gospel is about good news. It's about what Jesus has done for us, not what we're doing for him. And what I want to get at today, what I want to open up for you guys today, is the idea that the message of Jesus Christ requires us to know that message and to deeply to think about that message, to understand the nature of that message. But let me put it this way. It requires us not merely just to parrot little bits of soundbite dogmas to people, but it requires us to really think about what the nature of that message is, to dig down deep and to have our minds transformed by that message. One of the things that strikes me about the early church is how incredibly powerful their witness was to this faith in Jesus Christ, even while they were being persecuted for their faith. You understand that Christianity is unique in this sense. In some ways, it's a religion that grew not by force of any kind, certainly not militaristic force or physical force of any kind, but rather it grew not at the end of the spear, but at the spear coming at them. And so that as people were being persecuted, the church continued to grow. People wanted to be a part of this Christian thing. Why was that the case? Well, because the early church had been captivated by the person of Jesus Christ, because their claim was, and I hope this is ours, that he was the one in whom were hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, because he is the creator of all things, he's the redeemer of all things. And so commentator put it this way, that the early church, as they were captivated by that, they won their pagan neighbors, they won their pagan friends, their non-believing friends to Christ, because they, number one, outloved them, and number two, outthought them. Their minds and lives had been so captivated. The gospel was something that transformed the entirety of their lives. They could put it this way: they became attractive people inside and out. They had what you might call a beautiful mind. So they became known as thinking people. People thought deeply, even though they were being often derided for their faith. But people were stunned at the end of the day about how deeply they loved and how deeply they thought. And this attracted many to the beauty of the gospel. And by the way, this outloving and this outthinking was not some sort of gimmick that they developed in order to market their religion and their new religion to grow their tribe. No, rather it was inherent in the very nature of the good newsness of this message, the power of this message. So this is what I want to do. I want to dig down into 1 Peter chapter 3. And, we're going to look at several passages, but we'll start by digging down into 1 Peter chapter 3. And if you could, I want you to read with me, because what we're going to do, we're going to try to dig down into some particular words and then see what their importance is for us today. So, 1 Peter 3, I'm going to read this again. Verse 13, "Now, who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake," in other words, for doing what's right, you'll be blessed. "Have no fear of them, nor be troubled." And here's what I really want to drill down in verse 15. "But in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect." Now, Peter is telling them here that they need to be ready, prepared to give an explanation for the experience that they have of Jesus. But the key words that I want to see, first of all, heart. Notice it says that in your hearts honor Christ the Lord. What does he mean by this? Well, I mean, when we usually think in our modern use of the word heart, we usually set that against our head, don't we? We say, you know, I to have something in your heart is like deep down in your emotions, sort of a thing, and your head something else. But in that ancient way of thinking, the heart was a little bit more nuanced than that. It included thinking, it included thoughts, it included the seed of our thoughts, the seed of our passions and desires, of course, appetites and all that. So there was a much more holistic understanding of heart. But also, notice what he says then. He says, the next thing, set Christ as Lord, set him apart as Lord in your hearts. And then it says, always being prepared. The idea here is that of being ready for something because you have made the necessary preparations. Remember, you think of like the Minutemen at the Revolutionary War. You know, at any moment they were ready to go. They had their guns ready, any moment ready to go to battle. Because they were prepared. It's the idea of being on standby. You could almost translate it accomplished in the sense of like an accomplished pianist, like Catherine here. I'm going to embarrass her. But what I mean by that is that someone who knows how to play an instrument, they can sit down and play something, not like me. The only thing I know how to play on the piano is the beginning of... Jump by Van Halen. Anybody know that one? I'll play it for you later if you want me to. Okay. But they've trained themselves. So he says here, always being prepared. In other words, he's talking about people who have become accomplished, people who have made themselves ready because they've done the necessary preparations. For what? Well, to give a defense. Notice this word, defense. It's the word apologia. It's really the German, the Greek word from which we get our English word apology. He's not talking about making an apology, but just think about that word for a second. When you make an apology, why do you make an apology? You've done something, and so you say, I'm sorry, and then you give some sort of explanation. Oh, I'm so sorry for being late, but traffic was crazy. I'm so sorry for bumping into you, I didn't see you standing there, that sort of thing. You give some sort of defense or explanation. So there's something of that in here, but that's really not what he's talking about. In other words, he's not saying, be prepared to apologize for being a Christian. I'm so sorry I'm a Christian, I just can't help it. I was raised this way or something. No, no, no. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, rather, this word was used in this sense. It's a verbal defense, particularly in a law court. In other words, what he's saying is, be prepared to give an intelligent reasoning for why you have this hope within you. A reasoned argument, a legal defense, you might say, that presents evidence and supplies compelling proof as to why it is what you profess to believe is true. That's what he's saying. A reason. As a matter of fact, as he goes on, give a defense. To anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that's in you, that idea of reason, an account, a logical account, a reasoned, logical explanatory statement as to the truthfulness of Christianity. Now, what I want you to see here is this: when you begin to look at it this way, you begin to see that this presents a problem because the modern definition of faith is not the sort of thing that fits with what we've just been talking about here. The modern definition of faith, the popular definition of faith, is very different than the biblical definition of faith or belief that Peter is speaking of. The popular definition of faith, as a matter of fact, in the modern way that we tend to use faith, you have over here facts, and then over here you have faith, right? So facts are things that you know, and faith is things that you wish upon or believe or hope in the sense, I hope these things are true, right? Or facts are the objective truth. This is my private, personal truth. This is based on rationality. This is based on irrationality. This is based over here on evidence. In other words, I believe these things because of the evidence. Over here, I believe these things in spite of the evidence. As a matter of fact, you say, if you got great faith, he says, I don't care what the evidence is. I just believe. And really, that's crazy. That's just crazy. But that tends to be the modern way, even I think Christians often will think of faith. Faith is not trying hard to believe something that ain't so. Rather, it is a reasonable response to data, to truth. a reasonable response to what it is that you have investigated. Now, I had to drive down to New Haven almost to New Haven, Connecticut this past week for a pastor's meeting. And on my way down, I noticed something that I had never noticed before. If you've driven down Interstate 91 as of late, you'll notice that they've been doing quite a bit of construction on Interstate 91 where they're rebuilding bridges, not repairing bridges, I mean like taking bridges out and building new ones. And there's one spot there where it's a bridge over a pretty significant ravine. I mean, it's got to be 100, 200 or plus feet down there. And I've flown over that a zillion times, and I don't even think about it. I never thought about the incredible nature of the faith that it takes to be driving 65 miles an hour mile over one of those things, just assuming that those things are going to hold me up. And what struck me was they were constructing the bridge on the other side, and they were halfway across, and so I could see the cross-section of it. And it's like, the road was only about that thick. That's what it looked like. Maybe it was a perspectival thing, and it was thicker than it appeared. But I'm thinking, holy cow, that's kind of scary. You know, like if you get a bunch of 18-wheelers on there with a bunch of other cars and the traffic's backed up, is that really going to hold everything? But here's the thing. I mean, this is where faith and reason come in, or faith and evidence. I mean, you guys have been across those bridges a zillion times. They've proven themselves over and over again. You have faith, I hope, in the engineers. Maybe some of you guys are engineers out there, who have engineered those bridges, so they've done the mathematical equations and looked at the materials and say, yes, this is the right mix and size and thickness of everything and the right reinforcements. And so, all of these things, in some way, subconsciously, not that you're thinking through all of those details, but any time that you act in faith, there is evidence, there's some sort of reasoning that's going on behind it. And it could be good reason, you know. You may have said, you know, I thought I could trust this guy. You know, I thought I could trust this person. Shame on me that I was wrong, that I trusted this person. But you have reasoning that's going on inside of your head. There's some sort of rationality. It could be good rationality. It could be bad rationality. But we got to get the idea out of our head that faith is this thing that's just, well, God said it, I believe it, that settles it, I'm not thinking about it anymore. That's the very opposite of what Peter is saying here. Peter is saying that we should not be afraid one bit because we're so confident of the experience that we've had in Jesus Christ, to think through the faith and to not be afraid, but actually be prepared always to give a defense, yet with gentleness and respect, not arrogantly at all. I think back to an experience that was rather striking that I had quite a number of years ago when I lived in Michigan. I lived just outside of Ann Arbor, Michigan. Ann Arbor is where the University of Michigan is, and every summer they have this big Ann Arbor Arts Fair. And the art fair is, they block off all the streets. You've seen these sorts of things, and it's just, you know, hundreds of booths, and there's thousands of people walking the streets, that sort of thing. And so a buddy of mine and I were at the art fair, and we weren't paying much attention. We're just talking and walking, and we noticed there was this screaming and yelling over to the side here, and we look over, and it appears it was some sort of Christian booth or something like that. People are selling things, people are advertising things, and so there was a booth of some sort that had something to do with Christianity, and there was two people standing outside of the booth, an elderly couple, yelling, screaming, yelling, and making quite a scene and a fuss to the people who were behind the booth. And we're like, well, let's go over and check this out. So we walk over and we're just listening in. And it turns out this older couple was yelling and screaming at these guys. Stop, you shouldn't be out here. You guys have no right to be out here pushing this garbage on people. And they were harassing these Christians who had this booth. And so my friend and I looked at each other and we said, let's try to step in on this and see what we can do to try to defuse this. And so we started talking with this couple, and then they started turning their guns on us. What are you with them? Or, you know, you guys are crazy religious lunatics and this sort of thing. And this was an elderly couple, I would say, in their 70s or so, respectable-looking people otherwise. And we just kept engaging them, kept talking to them. I was particularly talking to the woman. Her name was Thelma. The other guy's name was Art. And it turns out that they were the head of the Atheist Association for the greater Detroit metro area. And I'm not sure they were representing their cause very well by what they were doing, but it was interesting. So we kept talking, and I was particularly, like I said, talking to Thelma, and which was a little bit strange because was this older woman, you know, who I felt like could have been my grandmother, and she just keeps yelling at me because I'm a Christian. And it was just a very surreal sort of experience for me. But after, 15 minutes, a half hour of going, I was asking questions, trying to understand, you know, where she's coming from, and you know, she's shooting all sorts of stuff at me. And all of a sudden, she just kind of paused, and she looked up at me, and she said, "You have an incredible mind. Why are you a Christian?" And I didn't know whether to take it as a compliment or a slam, but here's the point. Here's the point. When you understand that Christianity is about something objective, when it's about objective reasons, objective evidence, about something that really happened in space, time, and history, it's no longer about you. It's no longer about your private beliefs. You can engage with people with gentleness and respect and not take things personally. You know, this is not, at the end of the day, this is not about winning the argument, but it's really about winning friends. That's what's going on. And actually, it's kind of funny. I ended up having further interactions with them in other contexts where I just happened to run into them by the providence of God. Don't tell them that it was the providence of God, but it was really, really quite telling to me. And then, by the way, so this idea is that we are to have our minds prepared. We are to think through the objective nature of the gospel of Jesus Christ, trying to think through the reasons, the evidence, and all this sort of stuff. We're to think. This is all the more punctuated by another passage that I really want to emphasize here today, and that's the passage from 1 Peter 1. This is the passage that's at the top of the passage that I have printed, 1 Peter 1, verse 13. This is, by the way, verse 13 here marks the first commandment that's given, the first command that's given in the book of 1 Peter. Up to this point, Peter is just talking about who he is, who they are, and who God is, and what God has done for them in Jesus Christ. And so finally he gets to the point where he's saying, therefore, this is what you need to do. And what's striking to me right off the bat is that the first thing he tells them is, if you want to be a Christian, if you want to walk with God, the very first thing he says, you have to think. You cannot put your brain on autopilot. You have to think. Look what he says. Therefore, preparing your minds for action. And as a matter of fact, he goes on, and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that's brought to you. Now, when he says here, prepare your minds, I want to drill down on this word minds, because this is a very interesting word. It could be translated thoughts, imaginations, understanding, intellect, insight, reasoning. It's from the verb to understand, to consider, to conceive, to apprehend, to think. But what's most interesting is the compound nature of this word, because it's actually the word, if you were to split the word apart, you know, these words are often compound words. If you were to split the word apart, it's not just the word for mind or think, it's the word for to think through something. To think, or you might say to think deeply about something. It has the idea of moving from one side of the issue to the other side of the issue in order to reach balance and full-orbed conclusions or full-orbed reasoning. It would be the word for critical thinking, dialectical thinking. In other words, let me put it this way, in light of the examples even that I gave you, it's the word that would allow you to, or that would force you to say, I need to get into Thelma's shoes and really consider the weight and perspective of where she's coming from. To think
through the seriousness of how she sees this and why she sees it that way. What are the evidences? What are the facts? What are the things she's seeing? What are the things she's not seeing? In order to understand her perspective and then bring that back onto the other side so that I've seen things from all perspectives. I'm engaging my mind in thorough reasoning that incorporates all sides of the issues, because classical Christianity is a thinking religion. It engages the whole mind. It doesn't believe in spite of the evidence. It believes in light of the evidence. Therefore, it is going to want to and have to engage all of the evidence. It's not afraid to do that. As a matter of fact, a professor at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland put it this way, Oliver O'Donovan. He says, a Christianity that will bear witness to God's word in Jesus Christ, evangelism, the thing we're talking about here, will be a speaking, thinking, arguing, debating, not in a bickering way, that's not what he's talking about, an arguing, debating Christianity, which will not be afraid to engage in the intellectual and philosophical contests in intellectual and philosophical contests with the prevailing dogmas of its day. Think, observe, analyze, to think through, to think all sides of the issue. Now, this does not mean that we naively receive and believe everything that is presented to us as truth and as facts. That would be absolutely, utterly foolish. As a matter of fact, it's the very opposite of what I'm saying. But we ought not to be afraid to engage those things. Cornelius Van Til is a professor at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, the late professor, quite a number of years ago now. He famously said, look, there's no such thing as brute facts. You know, in other words, people present this fact, people present this evidence. There's no such thing as brute evidence. There's no such thing as brute facts. That's one of the reasons why in a court of law, all evidence is cross-examined, isn't it? Because all evidence is spun. All evidence is interpreted. All evidence and facts are situated. All data comes with a certain context. And actually, sometimes it's selected data. You have this much data, and we're only going to show this much data. See, it's true data, but it's not the whole data, right? And so this is the reason why we have to think through everything. Let me give you one example of how we need to think through all of the supposed facts that are presented to us. One of the most commonly cited facts that we hear all the time in the media, everyday conversations in our community. It's everywhere. It's in the books we read, the movies we see. It's actually, I guarantee you, it's in your mind. It's there like a virus in your mind because it's everywhere. And it goes something like this. We all know that modern science has disproven Christianity. You ever hear that one? We all know, you know, that people used to think like this, but now we know. In modern science, so you can have your beliefs. That's fine. That's your personal beliefs. But we all know that modern science has disproven much of Christianity. Actually, it often will go much farther than that and say things like this. Historically, faith, the Christian faith and the Christian church in particular, have been the chief obstacles to genuine scientific progress. So it's been Christianity that's been put the brakes on genuine scientific inquiry and progress. You heard this? I mean, it's all over the place in spades. Well, interestingly, just yesterday, I ended up was able to hear and a guy speak and then to engage him one-on-one personally at some length, a fellow by the name of Dr. Lawrence Principe, who is the professor of science, or the history of science and technology at Johns Hopkins University, and which is no small town school by any means. He's also a professor of chemistry, so he's a top-notch scientist, but he's also a top-notch historian, particularly on the history of science. And that's the realm in which this argument comes, because, well, we all know that, you know, before we knew science, you know, blah, 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 and it was Christianity that was holding back science, that sort of thing. And so he was speaking, and the main point of his talk was to try to debunk what he says, this is a myth. This is an absolute, utter myth. And he was trying to debunk and to show what the real history has been between Christianity and science. And this is what he said. He said, look, this whole idea that there, historically, that there's this war between science and Christianity, quote, is a complete historical fabrication. A complete historical fabrication. As a matter of fact, so actually when I was talking with him one-on-one, I was pushing back on him. I'm thinking, listen, Larry, I taught to professors all the time. I talk to academic people all the time. I listen to interviews from academic and scientists all the time, and this is not what I hear from them. I'm struggling when you say that you're so resolute on this, that this is an absolute fabrication. And he says, look, no academic scholarly historian of the history of science. So he's speaking about a very specific field that deals with this issue, okay? In other words, you don't go to an auto mechanic to talk about, foot problems, right? So he's talking about the specific field of the history of science. And he's like top notch in this field. He says, no academic scholarly historian of history believes this myth of the warfare between science and Christianity. And I'm saying, what? So why is this so intuitive to us? This is like everywhere. It's in the air we breathe, the water we drink, and he just pointed out that these myths have staying power. These myths develop and they have staying power for a variety of sociological reasons. Let me quote from a guy that he didn't give me, but it made me think of this quote by James Harvey Robinson, who is a pretty well-known historian and educator from a generation or so ago, said that most of our so-called reasoning consists in finding arguments for going on believing what we already do. And academics and intellectuals are no different on this point, he pointed out. And so he pointed out that many scientists, this is a belief that psychologically and sociologically functions for the realm of science. So many scientists have been catechized, if you will, discipled, brainwashed into this view since they were little kids, and that's why they went into science, because they wanted to be on the side of progress, and they pat themselves on the back that, well, we've moved away from the dark ages. And we no longer, and now we have the truth, and I'm a part of the vanguard, truth defenders here over against the naive religious faith people, right? And the general public has been trained to think of scientists as a sort of priesthood. And so when a scientist speaks and says, I have scientific knowledge, I have scientific proof, it's like, yes, whatever you say, it can't be questioned. Kind of like a sort of, blind priest, blind view, blind faith in a priesthood. And the mass media loves to tell a story because that's what sells. And a good story always has conflict and intrigue. And so they love to find a conflict and play it up. And there's a whole source of, and I'm thinking, wow, this is really interesting. And this guy's like the top academic, secular academic guy on this subject. I thought it was unbelievable engaging with him on this. And a real privilege to be able to do so. But here's the point. This requires you to not only believe the gospel, but also to question things and to think through things. Not, by the way, with a chip on our shoulder, but with gentleness and respect as we engage and try to think through these things and to study. Christians are not to be afraid at all of thinking and investigating all sides of any issue, considering any bit of data, because we're confident that all reality is God's reality. And so we see again, actually, in the passage, continuing this passage, it says, therefore preparing your minds, verse 13, for action and being sober-minded. Very interesting. Sober-minded, obviously, it has a literal meaning of not being drunk, But probably what's being got at here is not just that per se, so much as it is being calm and collected in spirit, temperate, dispassionate, circumspect. In other words, having the sort of temper that you're able to think through things without jumping to conclusions or overreacting. You're to be sober-minded, to be a clear-thinking sort of person. A Christian, because he is captivated by Christ, wants to think and to think thoroughly and to think clearly through these things. But what I also want you to see with all of this stuff is this seems to suggest that whatever is not rooted in the gospel way, this gospel way of thinking, is actually ultimately irrational. That's really what he's saying. If he's saying, look, you need to present a reason, what he's saying is that Christianity, this gospel thing, is the ultimate rationality. And if you don't begin and end with this God who has revealed himself in Jesus Christ, at some point your system's going to break down. There's going to be holes in it. It's not going to be able to hold the water of rationality. It's going to get leaky. And boy, one of the things that hit me as I was thinking through this week was a fellow by the name of Sam Harris. You may be familiar with Sam Harris, who actually is top-notch neuroscientist, but particularly known for his outspoken atheism. He's one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. That's what they call themselves. Daniel Dennett, the late Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, and Sam Harris. Sam Harris is the younger one of the bunch. But he's a neuroscientist and committed to this materialistic notion, anti-supernaturalism sort of thing. Obviously incredibly intelligent, way smarter than me. If I got in a debate with him, I'm sure he would beat me, which debates don't really prove anything. It just helps you to think through the issues. But he's just a smart, very intelligent guy. But he wrote the book End of Faith, Letters to a Christian Nation. If you've ever read these or heard of these things, you see him in the news every once in a while. But here's the thing. He's a neuroscientist, and he says all that exists is matter, space, time, chance. And so he's looking, he really falls into this false notion of what we might call scientism, that the only thing that exists is what I can observe under the microscope, right? Scientific, quote-unquote scientific data, and here's the truth, and there's nothing outside of that, right? And I was struck by this because what he says, at the end of the day, when you start following that all the way through and you say there is no God, there is no soul, at the end of the day, you're left with absolute, utter irrationality. And sometimes people will want to believe that because then they can excuse their choices, right? But it's not rationality, my friends. And it's not rationality. Listen to this. I'm going to give you a quote from Sam Harris. As I thought through this week, I'm like, wow. This is what he says. He says, the self is an illusion. The sense of being an ego, an I, a thinker of thoughts in addition to the thoughts, an experiencer in addition to the experience, that sense of being a subject, of a locus of consciousness, is an illusion. This is like one of the top intellectual thinkers, supposedly, of our day. Listen, there's not one unitary self that is carried through from one moment to the next, unchanging. And then he goes on to suggest, here, if you lose your sense of a unitary self, if you lose your sense that there is a permanent unchanging center to consciousness, your experience of the world actually becomes more faithful to the facts. It's not a distortion of the way things are. At the level of the brain, it actually brings your experience into closer register with how we think things actually are. Now, what is he saying here? You got to tease this out. And I know this is going to be hard to follow. It's a little tricky to follow. Harris goes on to say that the idea of free will, and what he means here, that we are free moral agents with moral responsibility, right, is incoherent and, quote, cannot be mapped onto any conceivable reality of what's there. What is Harris saying? Do you see what Harris is saying? What he's saying is, look, scientifically, you are in this, and that's the only truth there is. You are only a bundle of atoms, and your sense of being a you is a quote you, unquote you, is the illusion produced by randomly firing neurons. Now listen, and he'll present this. This is scientific fact, and if you don't agree with it, you're just wishful thinking. You've lost rationality. Listen, here's what I want to say. Sorry, Sam, and you're a lot smarter than me, but this is not science. This is not science at all. You've left the realm of science. Actually, what you're doing is undercutting the possibility of a scientific framework, because there's no scientific observer left in this proposed view of reality, only an illusion produced by neurons firing in the brain. And this is not raw scientific data, I would argue, but it's what it actually is Buddhism that's smuggled in, or better said, imperializing genuine scientific data, because we do have neurons firing in our brain. Right? Now, if all sense of self is just an illusion, then the self that just thought that thought is also just an illusion. So what's the point? You lose any ability to reason. You lose any realm of rationality. Actually, he tries to, in a very interesting way, he says, he puts this under the banner of self-transcendence. That if you could get into this mode, you would achieve self-transcendence. This is a scientist talking. But actually, here's the problem. If what you're saying is true, there was never any self to transcend to begin with. And besides, once one has experienced this transcendence, who is exactly left to enjoy the experience? Because you're a nobody. You're a nothingness in nowhere. You aren't even there, you see? It's really crazy at the end of the day. But it sounds, in one sense, so intelligent, though maybe if you feel that this is mind-bogglingly irrational, I think you're right. If there's no you there, then there's no other. We're all illusions. Actually, he goes on to say that to talk about the virtues of psychedelic drugs. No, I'm dead serious. The use of psychedelic drugs to try to develop the experience of meaning in the midst of this. So, look, but here's the point. Peter tells me, by the way, this is just Timothy Leary rehash. You may remember Timothy Leary? You guys don't? Oh, golly. You're afraid so? Yeah, I got the privilege of meeting Timothy Leary one time, believe it or not. He barely. Dr. Timothy Leary. But Peter, here's the point. Peter tells us that the Christian is to be sober-minded. He's to be connected as a real observer to a reality that is really there. The Christian framework provides a framework for genuine rationality. And the gospel of Jesus Christ tells us that you are real. Listen, you here, sitting here today, you are real. Your experience is not an illusion. The you-ness of you that you experience is really there. And the otherness of the other people that are here is really there. And the reality that you experience of the world is really there. And this is the rational world in which we live. You can observe that reality. You can engage that reality. You can ponder that reality. You can test that reality. Because there's a creator God who's made it all and sustains it all. And it's because of that creator God that we have hope. One of the things that's interesting as I end here is that all this idea of thinking, all of this idea of preparing our minds to give an answer, preparing our minds and being sober-minded, it's set in the context of hope. Look at 1 Peter 1 again. It says, preparing your minds and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that has been brought to you, the revelation, the unveiling of Jesus Christ. 1 Peter 3 now, that we're to make it, be ready to give a defense, make a defense of the hope that is in you. Martin Luther, the reformer, famously said that everything that is done in this world is done by hope. In other words, you have some sort of idea of what ultimate value will be. And that's our ultimate hope. And we set our hope on that. And here's the reality. Here's the amazing thing of the Christian hope. The Christian hope tells us that this one who made all things also came down to us in our fallen, feeble state and became one of us. He entered, feel it, I don't know, grab something right now. He entered the real world so that he might take on the reality of your existence, so that he might make you one with him through faith in Jesus Christ, because of the cross of Jesus Christ, because of his death, burial, and resurrection for you. And the Christian says, let's test this. Let's see, is there historical evidence for the entry of this God into the world? The Bible's all about that. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, look, if Jesus Christ is not risen bodily from the dead in real space-time history, if he didn't really get splinters on his back as he was trying to take those last breath on the cross, if he doesn't have real nail-pierced hands and now raised, resurrected forever bodily, if that did not really happen, give it up. Go do acid. Paul might as well say, you're most to be pitied. But if he did, you have a hope that is unshakable, undefiled, imperishable, waiting for you, reserved for you, for the last day at the revealing of this, in glory of this same one, Jesus Christ. And so we need not be afraid. We need not be ashamed. We're able to move into these questions. We're able to move into engagement with non-believing people. Not worried about not having all the answers. One of the best things you can do if you're interacting with a non-believer, say, I never thought about that. I would really look forward to thinking about that some more. Because because if this is true, Christianity is not something you hold up. Like, it's like that thing about Jesus. Oh, he needs friends. He needs a little help. Christianity is not some sort of system that you've got to hold up. It's falling apart because all this secular assault. No, the truth is, if it's true, if the truth claims are true, it's something that holds you up. You're being supported by his nail-scarred hands, by the word of his power. This is something different. Father, I pray that you would help us to be those that study your word, dig into the knowledge of God, that we would train our minds, prepare our minds to be ready. We'd be sober-minded. We'd prepare our minds for action, that we might be able to present ourselves to you in a way that would honor you and fill us with joy because of what you've done for us in Jesus Christ. Amen.